Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court?
Yes, it does.
Jeannie Willoughby on behalf of Leonard Taylor. Mr. Taylor was convicted of 4 counts of first-degree murder and has been sentenced to death for each of those counts. In Part 1 of Argument 1, we assert that trial counsel was ineffective for failing to adequately examine the phone records in the case, and then after adequately examining the phone records, to cross-examine the records custodians and bring out the inaccuracies and the omissions in the phone records, so that the jury was left with an accurate impression of what the records could actually show and what the records could not
show. How is this prejudicial? The defendant pled, he confessed to and the jury, he confessed. How are these phone records really prejudicial to the verdict?
The primary reason that they were prejudicial was because immediately after the victims' bodies were found, there were three family members of the victims, three loved ones of the victims. And at that point, December 3rd, 2004, they told the police that they had just spoken with the victims the weekend after Thanksgiving, the weekend before December 3rd, which is the weekend after Thanksgiving, Leonard Taylor having flew out of Lambert Airport on November 26th. So you had three separate family members telling the police immediately after, and they also stated this in pretrial depositions, that they had spoken to the victims over the phone. They had phone contact with the victims at the weekend after Thanksgiving, which was after Leonard had flew out of St. Louis. Why this is prejudicial was because, as you can see from the transcript, when the defense tried to call Beverly and Sherry Conley, and then they attempted, or they used the deposition of the Angela Rose sister, when they tried to call them, they made it clear that they were taking back their statements that they had talked with the victims on the phone because they had viewed these Charter landline records, and they were under the impression, as the jury would have been under the impression, because there was no evidence to the contrary, that these Charter landline records definitely showed all outgoing calls. So the phone records were a significant piece of the state's circumstantial evidence case.
And none of the missing phone call records that you identified by looking at recipients' phone calls and people who placed it and so forth, all the ones where you found discrepancies were prior to the date that the defendant left town, right?
That's true.
But you're asking for the inference that if there were some that weren't shown at that time, there may have been some that weren't shown later too? Or
I'm not necessarily asking for that inference. I'm saying that the state could not have told the jury that because these calls were not on the records, that proved Beverly Conley was wrong, Sherry Conley was wrong, and Juwan Rowe was wrong when they told the police that they spoke to them the weekend after. So what we're saying,
well, the lack of records is evidence of it, but you're saying it wasn't conclusive. I mean, the lack of records of any calls is certainly relevant evidence that they're right.
Right, but they couldn't use those phone records to say that this call was definitely not made because those phone records did not show all outgoing calls. The phone records did not show all incoming calls. The phone records contained errors in that there were times when Juwan Rowe called Angela's Charter landline, was discovered later, and a different phone number showing up. So you can't use phone records to argue to the jury, that call is not on here, so that definitely proves that Beverly and Sherry Conley are wrong. Now, you may have been able to argue, if the jury had that accurate information about what these records show, the state may have been able to argue these records are only a reflection, the phone records are only a reflection of what the company actually recorded. They cannot say what call was not made. It cannot prove a call was not made because the company doesn't record all the calls. So at most, I mean, they could have informed the jury, but that call is not showing up. But that's different from saying these phone records definitely prove that the Conleys were wrong because these phone records show all outgoing calls and that call is not on the record.
What was the evidence? I was a little confused as to I know there's a disclaimer that the telephone company sends out. What was the evidence as to what they did during this period of time? Was it automatic? Was there, because I take it the state says they, I believe the state says they didn't see it, but you had evidence that it would have been automatic to send that out, or
no,
is that unclear?
I think that the prosecutor was being truthful when they didn't get the disclaimer either.
Because the disclaimer
and the defense attorney
started later, is that right?
There was a disclaimer in existence at the time of trial. But what happened was, my understanding of what happened is...
But not at the time of the offense.
That's my understanding. Yes, that's right. That's right. Their charter didn't not have a disclaimer at the time of the offense. By the time of trial and before trial, they had a disclaimer in place.
And someone testified at trial that this would have recorded all the calls. And are you saying that person lied or they were just mistaken, or... How
I don't
are you
think
saying
she intentionally lied, but what she told the jury was false. I don't think that the records custodian was intentionally lying. She told the jury, they call the charter records custodian, and she testifies that the charter records contain some incoming calls, but all outgoing calls.
And that was inaccurate.
Yeah, because later, if you closely examine the records, you could see there were times when Angela Rose's landline number is coming up on Perry Taylor. And
your argument is that counsel was ineffective in just accepting that statement at face value and not going behind it to look at the records
absolutely,
themselves.
Absolutely, because that was their defense. I mean, their defense was calling the Conleys. I mean, they called other witnesses as well. But the three witnesses that they called that had phone contact, well, they didn't call Jerwan, they used her deposition. The state, when they got up to argue, these quotations in the brief, when they got up to argue, they told the jury, you know, Jerwan is wrong. Beverly and Sherry Conley are wrong. They said that they talked to them immediately after, but they were, you know, in the middle of this terrible situation, and they were mistaken. So in that sense, you know, that was false. I mean, the jury was left with the false impression of what the records...
Am I mistaken, but I thought I read in the briefs that defense counsel knew the records were not totally accurate and presented that to the jury.
The defense counsel did, she was aware that Charter didn't show all incoming. Mm-hmm. Charter landline, the victim's landline, did not show all incoming. That was adduced before the jury. Charter, so she argued in part during her closing, you can't rely on these phone records, they don't show the entire picture. But she never adduced that not only did the Charter landline not show all incoming, it also didn't show all outgoing.
But so did she say you can't rely on these phone records and limit it to only incoming calls? Or did
yes.
she just say this just shows the records aren't accurate?
I think that she never argued. They never really, if you look at the closing argument, they were never really able to rebut the state's argument that these phone records disprove what the Conleys told the police and what Jerwan was saying about phone contact with the victims after Leonard left town. They were never able. Now, she did. I'm not saying she didn't question the records. They were trying to question the records. But they didn't do everything they could have, because the only thing they were able to bring out was that Charter didn't show all incoming, and that, you know, something very obvious was that Jerwan Rose's cell phone records just showed the word incoming instead of an incoming number. So she pointed that out too. But again, she didn't bring out that Jerwan's records also, there were times when Angela called her and there was not even the designation of incoming.
How should defense counsel have known this when the records custodian was telling them that they were accurate records?
Well, I think that any time, you know, as this court has said in Gill, any time the Gill versus State, any time the defense counsel gets evidence of guilt, you know, they have to do an adequate examination of that. And these phone records were a significant part of the state's circumstantial evidence part of its case. They were a huge part of it. They created graphs from it. They called the records custodians not only to lay a foundation for the admission, but to explain it, to point out certain records. So these phone records were critical in this case. The jury asked for the phone records during deliberations. So, I mean, and they were trying to attack the phone records, but I mean, I think they should have known by just looking at them very closely. In the same way that post-conviction counsel...
You think they should have compared all the records, one versus the other, and matched them, and that's what was done for post-conviction, is that correct?
Right, that's what post-conviction counsel compared, you know, took one every time Leonard Taylor's number, on Leonard Taylor's, every time her number showed up, look over here, wait a minute, there's no outgoing call. I mean, it wasn't anything that required valiant effort. It was a matter of, it was tedious, you know, but it wasn't anything that if it's evidence of guilt, I think as this court said in Gill, you have to look closely at it and make sure that, is it really true that they contain all outgoing calls? I mean, that's quite a heavy representation, that these phone records contain all outgoing calls. It would be something that I would think one would naturally want to question.
But is that a standard that we should employ? Is that if a post-conviction counsel discovers an error or performs the task to discover the error, then it should have been discoverable by trial counsel?
I don't necessarily know. I guess it depends upon what the record would be. I would say it would depend upon the facts. But certainly, I mean, as this court noted, again, in Gill versus State, I mean, there was a police report about the victim's computer. That wasn't necessarily a significant report, and yet this court said they should have looked at the report, and if they would have read the report, they would have seen that indications in the report would have led them to question whether the victim had pornography on the computer because of the names of some of the files in the computer that were on the report. So, I mean, that report, well, that was the penalty phase. That report necessarily wasn't seemingly on its face that significant, and yet this court found that defense counsel, when they should have reviewed it because it was part of the discovery, and then when they reviewed it, they should have questioned, well, what was on the victim's computer? You know, they should have investigated further. Now, these phone records, they were a huge part of the case. I mean, you can see that from the closings. You can see that from the graphs that the state used to create these records. You can see it from the length of the testimony of both records custodians, and you can see it from the state's closing argument, that they really emphasized the phone records. So I think in this case, it's even easier for this court to say that defense counsel should have looked at those records closely. And it wasn't, I mean, if they would have looked at it closely, even comparing when, there's four sets of records primarily. They weren't huge. I think Angela Rose was 28 pages, a lot of entries. Perry Taylor's didn't start till November 24th, 2004, and ended in December, less than a month.
But is there a difference between looking at these kind of records closely, which to me it seems like you'd have to really dig into the discrepancies between the two reports, as opposed to in Gill, the names of some of those websites were pretty glaringly and obviously, you know, pornographic names.
That's true. So it was obvious from the report that they should have questioned it. I would say in this particular case, where you have your client saying that he didn't do this and he's claiming that he's innocent, and you have three of your key witnesses that are saying they talked to the victims over the phone, and you're going to call these people to the stand, I think you do have, and the charter person is saying that they contain all outgoing calls, and that's going to knock.
When did she find out what the, when did defense counsel find out what the testimony of the custodian was going to be?
Of what now?
The records custodian. Was there a deposition of the records
custodian? Yes, there was a deposition, and now I can't remember when that. There was a deposition. The trial was in 2008. The deposition was at some point in 2007. And so, she testified.
So at least for a matter of months, the defense counsel would have known what the witness was going to say about what the records contain.
That's correct, because one of the defense attorneys testified at post-conviction hearing. The charter records custodian told us at the deposition the charter contained all outgoing calls, and we were, quote, stuck with that representation. In other words, they didn't like that, but they were stuck with it. So I think maybe that would be a good point to say that in that situation, they should have looked. That's even more reason why they should have looked closely at the records.
The three family members who said they'd spoken to the victim after Thanksgiving, did they say those were outgoing calls from her to them or incoming calls from them to her?
Beverly Conley testified that the little girl, the oldest little girl, Alexis, called her Saturday night, woke her up November 28th, and from Alexis' home. So it would have been an outgoing call from Charter to Beverly Conley's number. Jerwan Rowe testified that, and this was on direct appeal, some of this didn't come in, the issue that was raised in direct appeal that they should have let more of Jerwan's testimony come in, that Angela called her from a Amoco payphone early Sunday morning at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning from an Amoco payphone. So that wouldn't have been from Charter, but she said that she talked to her on Thanksgiving over the phone, and I can't remember if it's clear.
Because to the extent it was the incoming and we already knew those weren't complete, that would have been before the jury. But there was at least one that was outgoing.
Yes.
You have time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you. You may proceed, Mr. Booth.
May it please the court.
It does.
The thing that the defendant forgets in making this claim is that while the Sprint records, and we're talking about five calls of apparently 30 seconds or less that were shown as incoming calls on Sprint phone records for the defendant and his brother as coming from the victim's landline phone in a period of time before defendant left St. Louis. All the evidence presented at the post-conviction showed was that the Sprint records showed these five calls as incoming and that the Charter records showed no corresponding outgoing calls. That does not prove that Charter's records were wrong. It does not prove Sprint's records were wrong. It doesn't prove that those calls actually were received and they were accurately recorded by Sprint, or that Charter's didn't accurately record an outgoing call.
What does it prove?
A discrepancy. And when the custodians of records were asked, and they did testify, both of them, Sprint and Charter, said our systems are designed to record all outgoing calls because those are identified by our equipment and that's what we bill for. We won't guarantee incoming calls because we get that information from other carriers, and so we can't guarantee the accuracy of that. That was all put out at trial.
Don't they do a disclaimer now for outgoing calls too?
Well, the disclaimer seems to just cut across. It doesn't differentiate between incoming and outgoing, and it seems more, drafted by attorneys just to cover all the bases.
But you're saying it might be that Sprint showed non-existent incoming calls that happened to be from the victim?
I don't think that the defendant at post-conviction proved that could not be the case. And the reason why I say that is the records custodian said that their equipment measured outgoing calls because that's their equipment. As for incoming calls, they get digitally transmitted information from all kinds of different carriers that has to be reformatted and then put into the formats that the receiving company has. When the Charter's custodian was asked, look at this discrepancy, now can you explain that? She said no, and added, I can't verify the accuracy of Sprint's records. That is not an admission that Charter's records were wrong.
But your strongest argument is not that maybe just by chance it happened to show the victim's number called this number five times. in addition to saying it's not just, maybe it's just a phantom call and it didn't really occur, you're arguing prejudice or what?
I'm arguing. Well, they have to show prejudice and they have to present evidence. And evidence that there's a discrepancy between one record and another does not prove that the record that shows a call, incoming call received, does not prove that there was actually an outgoing call from that particular number.
It sure would raise a question about that, wouldn't it, for the jury? I mean, if that's what your strongest argument is, say maybe there were phantom calls just by chance from the defendant, and that would be something I'd want to argue to the jury as defense counsel.
Well, the only reason why I say that, Your Honor, is this isn't trial anymore. This is post-conviction. We have a judgment. We've got a conviction. They're asking to set aside this conviction because of constitutionally ineffective assistance of counsel. To do that, they have to present some kind of evidence that there were actually outgoing calls made from the victim's landline after.
Or I think their argument is that they had to prove that they would have a viable argument to the jury that they couldn't rely on the records to show what calls were made because the records were not accurate.
And they made that argument certainly with respect to incoming calls. They also made that argument with respect to, well, maybe the calls occurred between the parties, not on the records that you have. And that was part of the victim's sister's testimony the hearsay testimony that she wanted to say that her sister told her she was calling from a payphone. But at trial, defense counsel was able to show that there was a record of her sister's cell phone showing a call from a gas station. And that matched up with what the sister said. I actually talked to my sister at that particular time. Or I actually talked to my sister after the date the defendant left town. The strongest argument, if you want to show Strickland prejudice, present evidence other than a discrepancy, because the discrepancy, if they're claiming that counsel should have argued the discrepancy, and I guess what they're not, and I was corrected in the reply brief that I had presumed, or the state had presumed, what the claim would be, that this was actual evidence of people in the house making phone calls after the defendant left town. Their sole claim is that counsel sort of just pointed this out to the jury, that there's five unexplained calls before the date the defendant left town. There's these five unexplained calls, and therefore you can't rely on the state's argument that, look, there's no phone activity after the date that they're showing no outgoing calls after the date the defendant left town. First, that's simply mere impeachment evidence, which all the cases hold is not sufficient.
Now, they cite a number where it was impeachment evidence, where it went to a central issue was.
A central issue, and Black is pretty much the predominant case from this court on that. And in Black, the impeachment evidence went to the issue of deliberation, which was very controverted in that particular case. And it made the difference between first-degree and second-degree murder and a death sentence and a life sentence or a sentence of a number of years. I think that case is distinguishable. Plus, we have other records showing, unless they're arguing that because of this discrepancy, and we don't know which phone company's records are correct, but because of this discrepancy, you can't rely on the Charter records for anything. You've got, before the defendant left town, we've got the victim averaging 36 calls a day from November 1st to November 23rd. After November 23rd, on November 24th and 25th, there's only 11 calls. Nine of those are attributable to the defendant. After he leaves town, there's no phone activity, outgoing calls. There's no calls to check voicemail, whereas before, and there were trial exhibits showing that the calls to voicemail that presumably the victim made before defendant left town and before she was presumably murdered. There are calls being made to check voicemail. Zero calls after the date the defendant leaves town. There's also evidence showing that incoming calls were being routed to voicemail exclusively after the day the defendant leaves town, simply because there's this unexplained discrepancy between two companies' records. In light of all this other information, the state would have still been able to argue a reasonable inference that the showing of no outgoing calls still, when compared with all this other activity, especially...
Would have said, even if it wasn't complete, the fact that there were none indicates some major change occurred in that at that time.
Exactly, Your Honor. And that's what gets me back to that, if at most, this is mere impeachment. I don't even think this gets into Strickland's front door of being able to show ineffective assistance, because if you want to show people were in that house using the telephone, still alive after the defendant left town, then present evidence of people actually in the house making phone calls after the date the defendant leaves town. They have five unexplained, and we don't know which company's records are correct. They've got five unexplained before then, none after that, though the aunts to the murdered children testified that they had told police originally that they thought they had talked to someone in the house, either Angela, the mom, or one of the children, after the date the defendant left town. At trial, they were shown the phone records. They were asked to think it over. The state showed them the phone records and asked to, I guess, during the investigation and check to see, do you believe this actually occurred after this particular date? And they both testified at trial, while they did originally told police that, they believe that they were mistaken, that they did not actually talk.
But opposing counsel's argument is that their change in belief as to the date was solely based on being told these records are accurate, they show you didn't call her then. And that's why it's so important and central. Or she didn't call you then, but there was no call.
Well, and there was other evidence. There was a friend of the victim, Angela, who testified that they talked frequently and that she called Angela after the date the defendant left town. She always would get a return call when she called and left a message, and she did not get a return call, which was unusual. The other thing I'd like to add about this is we seem to be looking at this in a vacuum, like this was the only evidence that showed the defendant committed these murders. And there are cases that talk about, when you're dealing with ineffective assistance claims, that attorneys are not ineffective for chasing down every possible shred of evidence when the circumstances would indicate that maybe the time that would be expended, which would be taken away from other matters, would not necessarily be fruitful. In this particular case, all you can show are five unexplained calls and discrepancies between the two phone company records. And also, we have no records from any other phone company for the date after the defendant left town showing a discrepancy during the relevant period in question, though during the post-conviction case there was an order issued by the post-conviction court granting access to the phone records, the defendant access to the phone records of these individuals that I mentioned earlier that thought they might have talked after the date the defendant left town, but then later decided that they were mistaken.
And there were no records of either phone of going in or out.
All I can say about it, Your Honor, is the court issued the order for these phone records, and there's no other mention of it in the post-conviction record.
Well, and that's part of it, is that those discrepancies could have been confirmed if defense counsel had access to the other side of the calls and chose not to present them to show that the discrepancies were wrong, that they were actually wrong.
Right. And think back, if you're a trial counsel and you start seeking orders for phone records for that period of time, what I think they put these witnesses on for was to try to just try to show the jury that there was a discrepancy, that these people actually thought they talked to someone in the house during this crucial period of time, and that the phone record, but they knew that the state was going to point out that the phone records show that there was no contact, and that these people, the aunts, were going to testify that they were actually mistaken.
Was there any other evidence? He'd left town. Was that the only defense? And the phone records were central, or was there other evidence of defense or of the state?
Well, the trial strategy was to cut down the amount of time that he had the opportunity to commit the murders, because the state alleged a period from November 22nd to December 3rd. And so it was very important, and they actually used the phone records. There was a trial strategy to use the phone records to show the defendant is out of town on the morning of November 26th. Well, that just leaves a couple of days for the defendant to have committed the murder, which is exactly what they were looking for. You narrow that window of opportunity. The phone records obviously were not the only evidence in the case to convict him. There was, of course, his brother's videotaped statement to police saying that the defendant had confessed to him. There's the phone records showing a lot of contact right around the time the state theorized the murders were committed. A lot of phone contact between defendant and his brother, between defendant's brother and their mother, and between defendant and his mother. There are calls from the victim's landline on November 24th to a family friend of defendant's, to defendant's brother, to Southwest Airlines. Defendant's brother admits to his girlfriend when he arrives. They have a phone call. Defendant's brother's an over-the-road trucker. His GPS records show he showed up in St. Louis on Thanksgiving Day on November 25th. There's testimony that from the defendant's brother's girlfriend that defendant's brother told her that defendant admitted to killing the victims. There's defendant's brother and the girlfriend get together when he arrives in St. Louis, and she overhears a phone call where defendant is still in the house, and the brother asks why, because there's bodies still there. And he mentions that he has turned the air conditioner all the way down to its lowest setting. And police find that when they go to the house.
And which is unusual because it's November.
Exactly, Your Honor, that the air conditioner is on at all. There's a can of air freshener in the kitchen with defendant's fingerprints on it. The defendant's sister-in-law, his wife's sister, sees him throw a black long-barreled revolver into a sewer right before the defendant. She takes the defendant to the airport. He was seen in possession of a similar gun a month earlier. He tells his sister-in-law on the way, or just before going to the airport, this is the last time she'll see him alive. She's going to hear things on the news about him that she shouldn't believe, and that he needs to leave St. Louis. Defendant's wife calls her sister, the one that took defendant to the airport, the next day, and she can hear in the background defendant, who's in California at this point, telling her to put the car that he arrived in into the garage, imploring her to get that car off the street and into the garage. And then defendant's brother later shows up to pick the car up. When the police find the car, they find a partial box of 38 special cartridges in it. The projectiles found in the house that killed the victims were from a 38 or a 357. The firearm examiner testified at trial that a 38 shell can be fired out of a 357 caliber gun. The victim does not show up for work and does not call in, which was unusual because, and this is on November 26th, 27th, 28th, she does not call in, but only a few days before that, on November 21st, she had called in sick to work. Defendant doesn't call the landline, victim's landline, after November 22nd. There's newspapers lying in the victim's yard dated November 26th and later, Thanksgiving being on November 25th. And I don't know if there was a direct testimony about there was no newspaper service, but there was a reasonable presumption that could be drawn that there wouldn't be. All the windows and doors to the house are locked. Now, defendant has access to the house because he stayed there with the victim and her children. The police have to pry open a window to get into the house. There's no front door damage. The house is not ransacked. And the TVs in the house are all turned on and the volume is turned all the way up. Defendant's not apprehended until December 9th. And he's trying to elude police when he's apprehended. He gives false name, false identification when he's apprehended. And finally, there's DNA. There's presumptive blood found on the defendant's sunglasses. A confirmatory test could not be done because of the small sample size, but the presumptive test showed blood, and then there's DNA in that sample, which means it had to come from either blood, saliva, or skin. The children were excluded as contributors, but Angela, the mother, was not excluded, and that particular DNA profile only occurred in 12,930 people in the African American population. Not confirmation of identity, but still relevant evidence. That was the gist of the state's case. The phone records were simply an add-on showing that, look, there's no outgoing calls from the victim's house after the date the defendant leaves town. And that, coupled with there's no showing of voicemail checks or that the incoming calls were being routed to voicemail, simply showing this discrepancy between the two telephone companies' records at a date before the relevant time in question, just doesn't amount to the prejudice necessary to show ineffective assistance of counsel.
Did D match the description of the man the neighbor saw going into the house around the relevant time?
I don't think so. I'm vaguely remembering there was some testimony that they saw a man going. One person saw a man going into the house, and I don't.
They said he wasn't identified as the defendant, and there was like a characteristic such as the light-colored skin, but I just didn't know if that matched the defendant.
I don't remember the state arguing that particular person's testimony, and I don't know if that might have even been defense evidence. That they certainly didn't argue that showed defendant or someone assisting defendant or anything like that going in or out of the house.
But you say it's a discrepancy. This is a capital punishment case, and the defense says it's reasonable doubt. Discrepancy versus reasonable doubt. They're trying to make the case that they should have had the opportunity to make their case better regarding reasonable doubt, and maybe the jury would find different. That's what we're talking about with prejudice to a certain extent.
Right. And ineffective assistance is just not, hey, give us a second go around. Hey, maybe we should have argued this, so let's have a second chance. To unsettle a conviction on constitutional grounds, you have to prove prejudice.
That's what Judge Russell's question went to a certain extent of was this new evidence that came up after the trial, or could the defense attorney?
No, this was all. And this is not a claim that they should have discovered evidence that they did. This was all in fact in front of the jury. They had these 28 pages and more than 28 pages of phone records, and that was all in front of the jury. The claim is they should have pointed out a discrepancy that occurred before the time in question to make an argument that the state shouldn't, or that the jury shouldn't rely totally on the fact that the record showed no outgoing calls during the time in question.
Thank you, Mr. Brookheim. Any other questions? Thank you.
Counsel, that's a big litany of other evidence that's there. Why would this have been prejudicial, making this one, not being able to make this one type of impeachment that these records weren't complete in light of everything else, in light of the lack of any calls at all? And all the other evidence. Why does it merit a new trial?
I think I'll try to break that down. First, I just tallied it. There were 29, you know, the seven times that Angela called Jerwan, didn't show up as an incoming. 17 times Jerwan called Angela, showed up as a different number. Five times that Angela made outgoing calls, not showing. There were 29 mistakes in those phone records from the period of November 22nd to December 3rd. One of the phone calls that showed up on Leonard Taylor's phone record that didn't show up as an outgoing call on Angela Rowe's landline was significant because it occurred on November 23rd at 10:27 p.m. And that was supposedly the night that they were engaging in this big fight. And immediate or shortly after that is when there's this alleged, well, it's not alleged, flurry of calls that Leonard is making to his mom, to other people, to his brother, and to his wife. And that's supposedly the state's theory that those are the panic calls that he's making after he's committed the offense. But she called him that night, showed up on Leonard, did not show up on her outgoing at 10:27.
What about opposing counsel's point that no calls were shown as outgoing from the victims or having been answered incoming at the victim's home, and that what you're showing now are discrepancies by comparing the victim's telephone number with the number of people with whom she normally communicated, and they showed calls that she didn't, or vice versa. But you subpoenaed or got permission to subpoena those records for after the defendant left town, yet didn't produce those at the post-conviction hearing. So you could have shown discrepancies after he left.
Well,
In other words, I didn't get all those.
Yeah, I didn't get all those records. I mean, it's outside of the record, so I don't know if it's appropriate.
But was there an order by the court saying you were entitled
to them? Right. I didn't get all of the records. I mean, Charter told me that it was either Sherry or Beverly Connolly had two phone numbers. One of the phone numbers I could not get that period of time. The other one, Charter said that she was not a subscriber for that phone number. Now, the information I had before we got the court order was that it was a Charter telephone number, and so that's why we got the court order for Charter as to one of her numbers. But I never, for one of the sisters, I didn't get any records, so I'll go on the record saying that. The other sister, I got what appeared to be a billing record to me because all of the originating numbers, 90% of them were her calling out. And so I assume, but no, I mean, honestly, that did not help us. So I didn't raise it as a post-conviction claim. But I don't think it's something that helps the state either. But no, I wasn't able to get all those. And I will say also, too, there's other issues pertaining to the records in the brief that were raised in the amended motion. If you look at the confession, that's a big part of their case. It doesn't have anything to do with the records. Perry Taylor was stopped, pulled over by police, arrested, questioned in Atlanta. He was pulled over by police, questioned in New Jersey, and he was pulled over by police and questioned in St. Louis. And that's when he told. So he was pulled over, arrested, questioned three times before he said that his brother confessed. There are issues with Perry Taylor's statement. Some of what he said was inconsistent. He originally told the police Leonard called 2 weeks before Thanksgiving and confessed. It's set forth in the brief, but there's a number of inconsistencies. Another inconsistency is Betty Byers saying that Perry Taylor was over at her home on Thanksgiving. That would have been Thanksgiving, November 25th, would have been the only night, according to GPS records and all these records, Lambert surveillance, that Leonard and Perry would have been in St. Louis at the same time during the time period of question. That would have been the only time this alleged conversation would have taken place, where Perry's saying over the phone, "What are you still doing in the house?" The state wants to use this, of course, because that's when allegedly Perry tells his girlfriend he's got the air conditioner on. That is a critical piece of evidence. But if you look at Perry's phone records closely, he was calling Betty Byers several times during that evening. So it's very unlikely that you'd be calling somebody if you're at their house. And that knocks down this whole testimony that she's giving, or her testimony is not matching up, that Perry Taylor was at her house having this conversation with Leonard while he's at the victim's house. Because Perry Taylor is calling her on Thanksgiving. So okay.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Very well argued. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Very much.